Greetings, creeps, and welcome to episode 16 of the Slashings podcast. I'm your host, JR, and this is where we discuss horror's influence from the silver screen and beyond. This is being recorded on Monday, September 28th, and the following interview was recorded on August 25th, which somehow feels like both yesterday and years ago at the exact same time. This episode's coming out on Tuesday 28th, and spooky season is well underway. Even those weirdos who wait till October to put up their decorations are finally starting to get ready for Halloween. This household follows a strict rule of no Halloween decorations up until the Yankee Candle Bony Bunch collection comes out, which I'm not crazy, Adam Green does the same thing. That collection usually drops at the end of August, so oh yeah, I've been decorated up all month here. If anyone feels like buying me the 12-foot skeleton from Home Depot, hit me up. Welcome to this week's episode of the Slashings podcast. I'm joined by my guest, Robert P. Atone.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well, how are you?
Not too bad.
For any of my listeners who may not be familiar, would you care to introduce yourself a little bit, please?
Sure. My name is Robert P. Otone, and I am an author and teacher and general ridiculous person from Long Island, New York.
Awesome. And you're obviously, that's why you're on this show. Your main focus for your writing has been horror-based with your collection of short stories, the original one, which was called People, and the upcoming one, which we'll get to in a moment, entitled Her Infernal Name and Other Nightmares.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Yeah. Horror is in the blood, it seems. And it's always been with me. And it's something I love writing. And it's just too much fun. I was listening to a podcast the other day, or actually, no, it was today. And a filmmaker was talking about how, you know, the movie Hereditary, if it was just a family drama, would be so boring. So dreadfully boring, but then you lop a kid's head off and there's demonic possession later and now you're in business. So I'm all about that.
Do you remember when you first started getting into horror?
I was probably like 4 or 5 years old, and my parents made sure to grow me up on the good stuff. And I watched Jaws, my dad's all-time favorite movie. Jaws was definitely a formative experience. Halloween, the original. There's, I don't know if you can see, I know this isn't a visual thing, but that's Haddonfield up there. Nice. That's like a lithograph of Haddonfield autographed by a bunch of people. So it's always with me. Haddonfield's always with me. But yeah, Halloween, Jaws, of course. So many classics. Godzilla. I was talking about Godzilla actually today. I grew up on a steady diet of Godzilla. So I don't know if a big kaiju monster movie is, or some kind of story like that might be, I might need to exercise that in some way. I don't know.
It's been a while since I've read a kaiju, either short story or novel. Actually, now I went to say that and realized I can't really think of any, unless you want to lob in like Lovecraftian entities into that realm, because like then you get like The Mist and stuff. But even that's not really, it's not really the same. It's not the same energy as the kaiju had.
No, totally. And it's funny, I was thinking of that as well. I have a story that's sort of similar to that, I guess, in Her Infernal Name, but it's not quite kaiju. Like, there would be nothing cooler than writing some big ridiculous monster emerging from the ocean that everybody has to fight back. It just sounds like a blast.
I'd be here for it, man. Because, like, Godzilla itself was definitely more rooted in environmental horror, and then, like, as it went on, it became more of, like, the way more kid-friendly, kid-centric, but still amazing, fun-to-watch movies with crazy cool monster designs, but definitely had its route in fear of the unknown and that nuclear war creating something we couldn't control or couldn't combat.
And I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say I remember as a kid loving baby Godzilla blowing the smoke rings and Daddy Godzilla teaching him how to blow fire. I remember thinking that was so cool. And then when I got older and I watched Godzilla 2000, and every time Godzilla blew the fire, a mini mushroom cloud happened. I was like, oh, and that's like, I knew that it was like a metaphor about nuclear war and the dangers of science and stuff like that. But then that, it really clicked with me. And I remember my first thought was, that's such a horrifying thing to still be afraid of, like this idea of nuclear war. And it's still very much a real threat, you know. But at the same time, just for 60 years, the people of Japan have been like, no, we have not, this is not a thing we're ever going to forget. So, like, this is still very much a terrifying concept to us. And there's so much power there.
Absolutely. And then, I'm also a huge Godzilla guy, so I could go on for like ever about just that whole like mythos and like the creation of it. And just the fact that it took a movie like that to kind of bring a lot of that awareness to like American shores. And then by the time it finally got here, like, you know what this movie needs? White people. And we just littered him with it and, like, bastardized the entire plot of the movie. Took out everything that was anti-America. Like, no, 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 you're ruining the entire point of this movie. It's not a, not necessarily about Godzilla himself, but the creation and the aftermath.
Let me ask you, I had a discussion with another author about this today. What is your opinion on the human characters in a kaiju, whether it's the newer King of the Monsters, which I loved. I know a lot of people didn't. I thought it was fantastic. Whether it's that or you go all the way back to the original Godzilla movies, all the Toho stuff. I don't really have too much of a problem with the humans in those. Like, to me, it's always the reactionary concept, and I'm there for the monsters, as I'm sure you are as well. Mm-hmm. But there's only really the one time where I could think of not really, not so much ignoring the humans, but being sort of invested in their story, and it was in Godzilla 85 when they brought Raymond Burr back.
Yep.
Do you feel the same way about the humans in Godzilla movies?
So I've been thinking about that a good amount lately, because I also love King of the Monsters. I thought it was awesome, and the fact that Michael Dowdy gets, like, that wasn't as loved as it should have been, because I saw that the day it came out. I ignored all reviews. I'm like, oh, people are going to love this shit, because it was the perfect blend of crazy monster fights and a decent human plot. But people don't ever seem to want to give a Godzilla movie a great review, because, like, when the one before that came out, people were like, oh, there's not enough Godzilla, too much human plot. And this one was, oh, there's too much monster, not enough human plot. Like, the human plot was ridiculous. Like, it was supposed to be a Godzilla movie. What movie are you trying to review?
Right.
So I love it, and I appreciate it, and it's definitely needed for a decent kaiju movie. Like, Pacific Rim had a really cool plot, too. Sure, I went to go see that for the giant Jaegers fighting the giant kaiju, but the human plot was integral to making that interesting.
Yeah.
If I wanted to watch robots and monsters fight, I would just play different video games. I need that plot, you know?
That's true. All right, so I'm glad we're on the same page there. That's good.
I missed doing Kaijun this year, and I'm kind of mad about it. Usually I'll watch a different, like, Japanese monster movie every day for the month of June, but completely missed the boat this year. Can't imagine what we were distracted with.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, it's like the world is peaceful. I don't know. It's crazy.
And on the loose topic of doing remakes, we brought back Godzilla a couple different times and rebooted that story. Something I would like to ask a couple different authors, I've asked a couple different authors, if you had to remake a book, rewrite it in the same way that we do redo movies, which book would you rewrite? Blech.
That's such a good question.
I know.
I would probably go with, God, I'm going to be eaten alive if people listening. I'm going to say Jaws. Okay. I would rewrite Jaws. Growing up on Long Island and being deathly afraid. I mean, you're an East Coast guy. You get it. Mm-hmm. Being deathly afraid of the water and the beach. And I still hate the beach to this day. And it's not, it's like, oh, maybe there's a shark. But, like, it has more to do with taking out the parts of that story that suck. Or the book. Like, the movie's perfect.
Yeah.
Like, that's 99 or 100 out of 100. But the book has, like, the mafia subplot, that can go. Hooper doesn't need to sleep with the chief's wife, that can go. Updating it, making, I would beef up Quint's part. I adore Quint. I think Quint is probably one of the three greatest movie characters of all time. And it has nothing, it has everything to do with Robert Shaw, but it also has so much to do with how interesting his backstory is. However, updating it, you lose the World War II story. So you'd have to find you'd have to find some comparable story to that. So I guess maybe if you made him a Vietnam veteran, I don't know of any shark history in Vietnam. I really don't know. I don't know if there are sharks in that area. I have no clue. But if you just update the USS Indianapolis story to be set in Vietnam, that could be terrifying. Chief Brody, I still think of this when I watch the movie, I still think of Chief Brody as Sonny from The French Connection. And after everything goes bad in The French Connection, he decides to leave and becomes this police chief in Amity Island kind of thing. And I think you can make him... He's already pretty hard-nosed and pretty tough and everything, but I think you could go a little further and maybe make him, especially if a modern New York City police detective, a former New York City police detective, fed up with the bureaucracy and fed up with maybe some sort of pushback or something. You can make him a little harder edged, and he goes to Amity Island. That's probably what I would do. I would do Jaws.
Hell yeah. Sold on
that. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there.
No, it's we're an audio-based format, my friend. The more tangents we go off on, the better.
Fair enough.
What have you been watching or reading during our super fun corona pandemic times?
I know everybody's talking about Host on Shudder, and I loved it. It was amazing. I've talked to the director a couple times, and I've begged him the second time, and this isn't a spoiler, but it is a reference to something that happens in the movie for those who haven't seen it. How does he do that full body burn? That drove me nuts when I saw that, because that's not CG. That's literally they lit somebody on fire, and he won't tell me. He straight up won't tell me. But I think Host is amazing. I've watched my favorite movie of the year is Dogs Don't Wear Pants. It's also on Shudder.
Okay.
It's a Finnish horror movie, and it's just such a masterpiece. It's more of a psychological, it's sort of a becoming story. It's not so much scary as it is just disquieting and a little uncomfortable. That's definitely my favorite. But right on the heels of that, and this is on Amazon Prime, The Droving. Unbelievable. It's like a modern Wicker Man meets Dead Man's Shoes.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm unfamiliar with The Droving. I'll have to check that out once we're done here.
Oh my God, you're in for a treat. I wish I could see it with fresh eyes again.
Nice, I'm excited to check that out. It's crazy how a lot of the media that's come out over these past couple months has been horror-centric. Now, it's easy for me to say that when, like, the news and the social media pages I follow and the news I read and watch is primarily horror-centric, so it seems like there's a lot in there. But Shudder is just crushing it with original after original coming out. And with Host being even filmed during all of this, and you're right, the special effects in that are insane for not having, like, an actual cast or crew. And, like, the little bits they've shown afterward, like how they did a couple of like the body rigs and stuff, was amazing.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't get over it. I and you know, I'm not like one of these tough guy horror people who's like, I never jump, I never get scared or anything. It happens all the time. But with Host, there was at least six or seven times where literally I was like, holy shit,
yeah,
when this stuff happened. And that doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes I'll just be disquieted or I'll think about it for a while. I'm not like a big gore person, even though I have some stories in the new book that are like a little gory, I guess. But I might have to watch Host again, actually. It was just so good. Oh, can I also make another recommendation if you haven't seen it? Lorcan Finnegan's Vivarium.
I've seen a couple posts about that. I need to watch that one.
Oh my God. It is so unbelievable. And it's definitely a dark take on things that I like to see explored in horror. The idea of the normalization of the relationship, the normalization of taking the next steps into adulthood, that kind of stuff. It is nightmarish. Oh, I remember I took I'm on Long Island, and it's nothing but suburbs here. It's awful. It's just rows of boring houses next to boring houses. And there's a scene in Vivarium where I think it's Jesse Eisenberg, who's never put out a bad performance, by the way. I don't know if we agree on that, but he goes on the roof of the house in Vivarium, and all around him is just this suburban nightmare where all the houses are the same roof, same everything. And I screenshotted it and I posted it on Instagram, and I was like, Long Island the movie. That's exactly what this is. It's a nightmare. But oh my God, it's so good. So I'm sorry to give you so many movies to watch.
How dare you apologize? There's gonna be more things to watch that I haven't seen. I'm down here with like an infinite number of movies on my shelves and a good number of different streaming services, and there's just so much. Like, I always hate seeing that post online of, oh, there's nothing good in horror to watch anymore. Like, what are you talking about? It's a literal bottomless pit of new things, either both new things and old things to watch. Like, we're in this awesome golden age of
small boutique labels putting out hard to find movies on Blu-ray and DVD, and then smaller people getting access to massive, like getting their movies on the massive streaming services. There's just so much to find out there.
I was just going to say that, and there's always these really Amazon Prime. I think this is sort of an untapped thing that people don't really know about. Amazon Prime has shorts and mm-hmm. short collections and anthologies that we've never heard of, but it's just, and yeah, some of them are not spectacular, but there's always at least one in these anthologies that's worth it. And they're just 45 minutes to an hour long. So it might be like five or six little shorts, but I found myself putting those on and just really enjoying the hell out of them. And I'm so happy that they put those on because we would never see them otherwise. I know Shudder does their, they have some shorts on there, and the shorts mm-hmm. on Shudder are like chef's kiss, but yeah, I'm just always shocked by how much Prime is committed to really cultivating horror on there. It's something like Netflix doesn't have much in the way of horror. They had that that awful, what was that movie with the elevator? What was that? The one with it's the two guys in the prison and it's like an elevator of food.
Oh, The Platform.
That's that one? It. Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't a huge fan, but I did watch it because I was like, oh, we have Netflix. Let's watch something on there other than The Office.
The body horror one they had was really good there, The Perfection.
Oh, yeah, you're right. The Perfection was excellent.
And then did you watch Marianne, that French horror one they had on there?
I did not. I'm sorry. That's the is that a witch movie? Yep.
It's the author who writes this character of Marianne the Witch who winds up becoming its own real entity or somewhere. It might have been based in some sort of reality. I don't know. I only watched it when it came out, but I adored it. And then they announced that it wasn't getting picked up for season two. Like, how could you give me like one of the best written horror things to come out on Netflix? Because you're right. There's not a whole lot on there for horror. Right. And just drop it. And I don't know. Netflix is becoming one of, in this borderline blasphemous, becoming one of my least favorite streaming services because there's not, all they're trying to push is their own material now, and it all has the same look. It all has that same Netflix veneer shine to it. There's not a lot of originality in the voices on it.
I agree with you. However, if they want to buy the rights to any of my stuff, by all means. No, I honestly, Netflix is my least favorite of all of them. It goes Shudder and then Hulu. Amazon Prime is, I love Amazon Prime, but like Shudder and then Hulu is such a sneaky good source of horror too. Just for Wounds is so good. And they're doing North American Lake Monsters as a series as well. And I cannot wait for that. But they also Hulu, I just watch Akira over and over and over on Hulu. So my girlfriend's always like, what are you watching? I'm like, obviously, Kaneda and Tetsuo, who are shooting each other with lasers and fleshy arms, of course. But, you know.
I'm ashamed to admit that I just watched Akira for the first time maybe 2 months ago.
What did you think?
Loved it. I don't think I or really anyone fully understands every facet of it, but I appreciated a lot of what it had to say and a lot of its like social commentary, too. So now yeah. I'm curious to pick up the mangas and read through those too, because that's a whole new world. Oh, don't do it.
There's so many of them. I had them for the longest time, and I read them, and I'd rather just watch the movie. I know like a lot of hardcore fans will be like, "Oh my god!" But yeah, for me, it's the movie. The comic is fine, but it's so much money and it's so much work. It's like trying to go through. I love Lord of the Rings, but I don't know that I have reading all of that in me anytime soon, or trying to read the Silmarillion. I definitely don't have that in me. So, I don't know. I would, if you want to try it, by all means. But you know, I read. I remember I was obsessed with the movie Old Boy.
Yep.
When it came out, I got to see that in theaters, and I was like, "This is amazing!" And I didn't stop thinking about that movie for years. And then I picked up the comics because they released the comics here. And I was so monumentally disappointed with the Old Boy comic compared to the movie. And of course, then I was disappointed by the Spike Lee remake of the.
So bad.
Oh my God.
It's weird to say that Spike Lee has a like 100% awful movie, but it was unnecessary, uncalled for, unnecessary. No one wanted it. It would be like remaking Takashi Miike's
Audition.
That too, but I'm thinking of Ichi the killer? Ichi the killer, thank you. I couldn't get Ichi in my mind, because I was thinking Old Boy and the adaptation from the comic to the movie. It would be like trying to remake that. No one wants it. No one's asking for it.
Did you ever see The Neighbor Number 13?
No.
Ooh, you should see that. It's also based on a comic. Takashi Miike is actually in it.
Oh, cool.
He plays like the lead character's neighbor or something, but it's basically like a really dark take on the concept of what's going on in Fight Club, like a dual personality situation. So good. Do whatever you have to do to watch The Neighbor Number 13. I recommend it.
You give me such a treasure trove of things to dig into. I'm excited.
I'm so sorry. I feel like such a jerk, but I'm just
no,
like,
don't be at all. That's one of my favorite things about talking with anyone with horror is, like we had mentioned earlier, it's a bottomless pit. My interest and your interest, sure, we're going to have overlapping things, but there's thousands of things that I haven't seen, assumably you haven't seen. There's just so much to dig into. I love it. And so the more recommendations I have, the better. Keep them coming.
Awesome.
Well, let's turn the spotlight back to our guest here. Talk about the things that we have going on in the new world of upcoming, or, well, actually, as of today when this episode comes out, freshly released horror anthology of shorts, well, a novella and shorts. Now, at this point in time, I'm going to start talking about the new book. So if you haven't picked it up yet, which you should have by the time you're listening to me talk about it, if you haven't, stop listening, because I'm going to talk about plot points and spoilers and stuff. So it is the full name of the collection is Her Infernal Name and Other Nightmares, which features the novella Her Infernal Name, which read through as I tried to wait until closer to our interview to read through it. So I did just read through the actual novella last night. It's this awesome blend of society meets social media influence meets living in New York. What was the additional inspiration for that?
I think I had been paying a lot of attention to, and reading articles about influencers and sort of this weird level of entitlement not in all of them, but in some. I'm on that Reddit of it's restaurant workers, and every once in a while they get an influencer in there who's like, hey, I should get my bill for free because I've got 5,000 followers on Instagram. And I was like, Jesus, can you imagine ever doing that? I just am like floored by that. So that's sort of where it started. And then at the time when I wrote it, I was teaching at a different school than I'm teaching at now. It's weird. Last year I went from being in a district where the kids were amazing and I loved the kids, but everything else about the school was awful. Leadership, everything was terrible. And I wasn't making the money that I'm making now. And I was feeling just so much pressure on me economically. And I was just getting very, very stressed out. So a lot of my stress about the economy and about my student loan debt and stuff like that blended with this. And Her Infernal Name was the result. And I love that you mentioned society, because I'm so glad that you get that part. Because I've always loved society, and I was really I think Joe Bob showed it on show. I'm pretty sure, right? Didn't he? Yeah. And my girlfriend saw it for the first time, and she's like, this movie is gross. I love it. And I was like, I know. It's so good. And I had already written the scene before we watched that together. But, of course, I had seen it years ago when I was a kid. But, I'm glad you mentioned that. So, like, I wanted to do something with body horror and something with just disgust and gross, and kind of put that against this glossy idea, this veneer that social media influencers always put up about having a great time and exploring the world and doing all this stuff. I actually know a social media influencer from here, just a nice enough girl, but she's always talking about how she's getting these offers to go on these guys' boats, to fly to these places and stuff. Not so much now with everything going on, but before all this. And it was like, what, you've gone on a couple of these trips. What exactly happens on these trips? And she's told me, and I was just like, skeeved out, I guess might be the word. And so I wanted to kind of put that, the reality of what I have heard some of these influencers do to have these great experiences and go on these vacations and take all these beautiful pictures and all these places and stuff. So I really wanted to play around with that and mix in a little shunting from time to time.
And what I liked about it a lot too is it kind of tiptoes back and forth of whether the horror elements are happening or it could very well be in her head, because it's not. Those are the things that scare me the most, is like the plots of like Rosemary's Baby, or I'm trying to think of another good example where it's just the entire world is against you. Like, she had both the main influencer chick, the doctor who she wound up seeing toward the end of it, the rest of the crew from the company who held her student debt, all saying, oh, no, you're good, this is all fine, it's all part of it. But you don't necessarily know, and even, again, we're getting super spoilery with it, with the tail end of it, you're still not 1,000% sure.
Yeah, I love all era of horror movies, but the 70s horror movies, that's the good kush for me. I love 70s horror movies so much. I especially love when a really great competent filmmaker can do a riff on a horror story that feels like a 70s horror movie. So I think for me, the actual novella, Her Infernal Name, was me trying to riff on concepts that would have been found in a 70s horror movie. And it's actually, this is probably going to sound blasphemous, I had never seen Rosemary's Baby until about two or three months ago.
Wow.
So when you mentioned Rosemary's Baby, and another critic mentioned Ira Levin and Rosemary's Baby and reading Her Infernal Name, I was like, oh, okay, that at least I know, I guess I did pretty well with that one. But I never saw it before. It's weird because I had seen The Stepford Wives, mm-hmm. which I just rewatched recently. Oddly enough, just as terrifying now as it was back then.
100%.
Oh my God. And my girlfriend had never seen it, so I made her watch it. And she was like, you're going to do this to me. And I was like, no. But I still find all of those concepts that worried people in the 70s are still very much so around now. Possibly even stronger now than they were back then, because the racial inequality is all still there. We're talking the late 60s with Night of the Living Dead and all that. It's still all there. Dawn of the Dead, it's all still there.
Yeah.
And it's magnified now because of what's going on. So I think that's part of where the story came from, because I just wanted to dive into that. This whole collection is all centered around the fears that I have or had or have, goes back and forth. And all of the stories were me trying to exercise all of these fears. And Her Infernal Name was the one about the economy and the stress of mounting pressures from outside forces and stuff like that.
So if each of these is one of your fears, are you afraid of solar panels or vampires?
maybe solar panels, because I know how expensive they are.
For whatever reason, it just, that one story in particular was like an odd palate cleanser in the midst of the book. I'm like, okay.
My editor, he did that on purpose, Lewis. He's like, I'm gonna play around with the order of these, because I sent them to him in one order and I was like, do whatever you want to do. And he was like, I'm gonna put this one right here because of everything that comes before it. We need a little sweetness. Yeah, I'm glad. I hope that one made you laugh.
absolutely, because you can almost peg it from the get go. As soon as you see the shadow upstairs, he opens the door. I was like, oh, we're at Skull Pile, and I'm like, all right, strike one at Skull Pile, dude. What are you doing? Now, a lot of the stories focus around, but have plots that take place in. I wrote the name of the town down because it was Hollow, Resting Hollow. What's the origin for Resting Hollow?
I wanted my own kind of, I love Washington Irving. He's probably one of my biggest literary heroes. He's sort of a weird controversial figure nowadays. And this is all kind of new to me, the controversy around him, but I still love him. Like, I could separate the art from the guy if this controversy is actually true. But I wanted my own version of Sleepy Hollow. Like, so the Sleepy Hollow Tarrytown area is where I always just feel at home there. My father is from that area originally, And we used to go there every year at Halloween. I went there last year at Halloween. I would like to go this year, but I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah, I wanted my own area that I could sort of play around with. And I've started building the area out a little bit more with something I'm working on now and a couple short stories that I've written after this. I've built out that sort of pseudo Hudson Valley-ish area.
Nice. Because it pops up in at least Kelly Watch the Sky panels and The Arborist. Yep. I'm sure I missed it in a couple others as well as I was streaming through. But I'll go back and comb and find it again.
Yeah, I've always loved the Silent Hill universe. Like, there's nothing that makes me happier than playing a Silent Hill game or watching a playthrough of PT, because I never got to play it myself. Did you ever play it, by the way?
I didn't get to, no.
Yeah, I really wish I could have. But I love the idea of a town where that punishes you for your sins. And at first I played around with the idea of Resting Hollow being that, but I liked it as this sort of focal point town. So I sort of created a town that's similar enough to Silent Hill that's like just northeast of Resting Hollow. So I'm sort of, like I said, I'm building things up a little bit more. And I just love the architecture of a shared universe as well. I mean, Stephen King does it. The Marvel universe is doing it. So I don't know. It's just, it's fun too. I've talked to some other authors and they find it limiting. I can't imagine why. I don't know. It just seems so fun, because whatever characters you have that survive the story or the book or whatever, if you like them enough and want to bring them back to confront something else, there's plausibility there. So I like it. I think it's fun.
It's strange to call it limiting when you look at the prolific works that we get from, like, the two examples you brought up, the Marvel Universe or Stephen King's Castle Rock, because there's so much he does in that town, and it changes over time. It's not, yes, there are parameters of the town that don't change, but there's so much you can dig in and find in that. Like, even the show based on the town is amazing, and it's its own original story that he didn't even write. There's so much you can do with Castle Rock, and ergo, you can do it with any limited or shared universe.
Right, and you know, I'm a big DC guy, so I'm wanting DC to kind of do all of this as well, but it just seems, they seem so resistant to it, and I can't imagine why. It's like, dude, it works. What's the problem? But I don't know. Even the John Carpenter stuff, he's talked about, while his end of the world triptych that he did or whatever, all he's said sort of takes place in the same universe, even though it's three different ends of the world, essentially. They all mm-hmm. take place in the same reality that he invents. Maybe they happen concurrently and they're all just different influences or whatever, but all of his stuff seems to take place in the same. Why does Christine pop up in, does it pop up in Vampires? Is that what, I don't remember, but I think they all take place in the same universe.
I don't think I've actually seen Vampires, and I'm a huge John Carpenter fan, so I don't like that sentence. I know! I'll defend The Ward all day long, but I haven't seen Vampires.
I like The Ward too, by the way. So The Ward is very good. But yeah, watch Vampires, man. James, it's the one time you're allowed to like James Woods.
So now we've got Christine showing up in that, as well as in the beginning of the anthology film Cat's Eye, so we've got a whole wider range of crossovers.
Right. Oh, and it's in, Christine is also in Body Bags.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why I always forget about Body Bags. I love a good anthology film, and that one just has so much character and fun with it. You can just tell that John Carpenter would just go into town with his goofy, like, Crypt Keeper-esque figure.
And oh, it's awesome.
He kind of aged to look almost exactly like it.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of weird, right? And I just love when Joe Dante pops up, Wes Craven pops up, all these cool guys. It's like, how can you hate this movie? It's so good. Mark Hamill.
Yep. Speaking of Mark Hamill and horror, are you a fan of What We Do in the Shadows, the TV show?
I have a Jackie Daytona t-shirt. So yes! Yes. Nothing makes me happier. I love... it's funny. I love the show so much more than the movie, but I enjoy the movie very much. Mm-hmm. But I think the show is just like an unmitigated masterpiece. I was hoping that this year, that it was going to be the big battle was going to be between Schitt's Creek and What We Do in the Shadows. And I wanted to see the two of them go head to head, because I'd be like, I don't, either whoever wins, we, whoever loses, we win. I don't know. This is so hard to choose. But like, Schitt's Creek got all of the acting nominations, and What We Do in the Shadows got all the technical stuff.
Yep.
Which is fine. I've been a huge Matt Berry fan since, God, I guess maybe the IT Crowd. No, since the Mighty Boosh.
Yeah,
and I've always been a big fan of the Mighty Boosh and all those guys and stuff. So seeing Matt Berry get like American acceptance, I've been waiting for this for almost 20 years. So I'm so happy.
Did you ever watch Garth Marenghi's Dark Place?
Hell yeah.
Oh, so good, dude. So good.
I want to see him come back. I want to see Matt Holness come back and do something. He doesn't do much. He strikes me as the most mysterious of them all. There's always, it's actually, there's not always, but he is very cagey about the things that he attaches himself to and talks about, but also he reminds me a lot of that, the Australian comedian Chris Lilley, who does all those character pieces. He has one on Netflix right now, Lunatics. They're both so cagey, and they never talk about their work. So when they do pop up in something, it's like, oh shit, that's them. Awesome. But yeah, Matthew Holness is a genius. And every once in a while, I put on One Track Lover and just sit back and let Matt Berry sing me to sleep. Oh, it's so good. Richard Ayoade is a genius.
Yep. I'm glad that we're getting some of that humor in American like television as well. It's just, it's neat to see it kind of translate now, so many years after the popularity of the original shows.
Yeah. And I maybe that, you know, I had a thought. I was thinking... couple days ago, you've seen Toast, right? You've watched Toast on Netflix, Matt Berry's other show.
I haven't watched Toast, dude. You're killing me.
I'm so sorry. he won a BAFTA. He won the BAFTA for it, which was huge. And he and Toast is amazing as well. He plays sort of this aging theater actor. And I had this thought: my God, what if FX did an original movie of Matt Berry's Toast character coming to the United States for something? Now that people know who Matt Berry is because of What We Do in the Shadows, this is a win. This is a huge win. But Toast is so good. It's so funny. So, so funny. And I mean, you know how funny Matt Berry could be because of What We Do in the Shadows. So, good. So
in my process of editing this episode, I'm going to have to like keep like a chronicalized list of things to watch and when to, I'll write you a full book report. You'll have my own like novel length list of everything I like from it. I keep getting distracted by other things. Back to the collection that's coming out. With Matt's in the Teacher's Lounge, the movie that they're going to go see, that they go out on their date for, that is House, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I kept waiting for you to say it. I'm like, all right, it's a Japanese movie. It's weird. It's a haunted thing. It's in the woods. Like, it's got to just say it.
I probably watch that at least 2 to 4 times a year. I love House so much. I'm dying to get the House t-shirt, the orange one with the cat on it. I'm disappointed in myself that I don't have it, to be honest. But yeah, oh God, do I love that movie. And actually, in writing the collection, I always put together a soundtrack to write with. Some writers don't like doing that, but Paul Tremblay mentioned on your show that he did that. He had some music playing and stuff, which I was like, yeah, cool. I do that too. That's good to know that he does that. But one of the songs was Cherries Were Made for Eating from the House soundtrack, because it's just so good. It's such a fun, wholesome, sweet song. And then Nat's in the Teacher's Lounge, I was like, what movie are they going to go see? Yeah, they're going to go see House, for sure. And that's sort of based on a true story, the Nat's in the Teacher's Lounge thing. Not like the spooky part, but the actual Nat's in the Teacher's Lounge itself. They were in the Teacher's Lounge of the school that I worked at last year, and it was disgusting.
Gross. Because you had mentioned something about the janitorial staff of the crew in your acknowledgement page for it. I'm like, okay, what's... I'm assuming there weren't bags of grossness hidden in places and the actual horror elements weren't, but good to know the Nat's Bureau. You never know.
I don't know. I'm not there anymore. Not my problem.
Now, with you creating the soundtrack for it, you also have that playlist listed in the beginning of the book, which you can access on Spotify, and it's a really cool playlist of songs that some of them fit, like, name by name for the short story, like Kelly Watch the Stars, which is not a song I had heard before. That's just groovy. There's a lot of good stuff on there.
Oh, good. I'm glad you like it. Yeah, I've loved that song for a long time. Air is such an amazing band. Everybody should give them a listen. They're from France, but... Yeah, there's just that song is so ethereal to me. And when I was thinking of what would be a good title for this story, her name is I was like, oh my God, Kelly Watched the Stars. It just makes sense. But yeah, I love doing that. I love putting together the soundtracks for the different books. I did it with my first collection, and I've done it for everything. I'm working on a YA novel right now, and I've put together a playlist for that one as well. And that one goes to some weird places. Even though it's a YA book, it goes to some surprisingly dark places. So I have, like, She Wants Revenge on there. I have some Angelo Badalamenti from Twin Peaks on there. It's really bonkers. But then I have stuff like, oh, here's a little bit of Grimes. Here's some Iggy Azalea. You know, it's just ridiculous.
Well, I just find it funny that YA was listed as a genre, because it as much as I want to fight it, it is, but it shouldn't be. Like, there's so many other genres that can exist in it. You can write that YA sci-fi novel, that horror novel, that historical fiction, but it all gets lumped into a genre of YA, which is weird, because you wouldn't say that for, like, a PG-13 movie isn't a genre, even though it's guided toward that kind of age group. So it's always seemed weird to me that YA was, like, its own label.
I agree. I think if it was coming out right now, it would be considered a YA novel, even with the stuff of in adulthood.
Because, yeah, it is, at its root, it is a coming-of-age story for those kids. So, yeah, I could see that.
Firestarter, too. Firestarter would all, and possibly Carrie. Definitely Carrie.
Oh, absolutely Carrie.
But we don't think of it like that. You and I, like, you know, but the two, I wrote one YA novel already, and it's very much a science fiction horror story. But at the same time, it ticks all the boxes of YA in a big way, in the sense that two of the lead characters are teenagers. And this new thing, only the main character is a teenager. So part of me has this feeling that, is this YA, even though the main character is a child, I don't think that that's going to limit any adult from being interested in this story. So I just don't know. I am writing it for a children's literature program that I'm in, an MFA program. So it is for that. But I think that there's, like you said, YA, it has such huge crossover appeal. I just read a YA novel that had way more bloodshed than the Brian Evanson short story collection that I'm reading. And he's a horror god. I'm floored by this. The sheer amount, it was gallons of blood. Insane.
And yet still like, oh no, this is for like 12 to 14 year olds.
Right, published by Disney. Published by Freeform. Freeform published and they're owned by Disney. It's like, there's literally a guy gets decapitated. There is a cross-dressing madman with blades and knives in this thing. Like, this is Disney. But I loved it. It was so good.
I'm glad that it has the marketing capability to put things out through YA, because you do have that built-in market already. But it kind of limits it, because you're going to have dudes in their early 30s, early 40s not reading. It's like, oh, that's meant for kids in high school. Like, no, dude, like, pick it up, open it up, read it. It's gross, I promise you.
Right. Lord of the Flies is a horror masterpiece.
Yeah.
It's YA.
It's terrifying, because I years later, well after reading Lord of the Flies and, like, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, somewhere in that ballpark, I have nightmares of the pig head on the fucking stick.
Absolutely.
You can't shake it. That's
that's arguably one of the most terrifying sequences ever written by a human being. It's horrifying. And it's, if it happened to any other character in that book, it wouldn't be quite so bad, because Ralph is too stupid to know what's going on. Jack would love it. Jack would be reveling in how crazy it is. But it happens to our Christ figure. It happens to Simon, the sweetest, most pure person, the one who's literally plucking fruit, ripe fruit, off the trees to give to the little ones who can't reach it. Like, he's just pure good. And he's confronted with ultimate evil, and it's awful. It's like The Exorcist. It's a child dealing with something so horrific, and that's what makes it so terrifying. But it's, God damn. Yeah, Lord of the Flies, man. Ugh.
Ugh. Seeing posts and rumors about an Exorcist remake supposedly supposed to come out next year.
Yeah.
There's no logic behind that. They can't make an entire movie of that size and caliber within a year. And why bother?
And also, they had that god-awful TV show, which I thought was going to be a riff on it, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, Gina Davis is Reagan, and it's what? It just didn't, I don't know. It didn't work for me. The second season I thought was great because John Cho is, I think he's one of our sneakiest, finest actors working today. I really love him. And he made that second season spectacular. But I don't see the need. I mean, we have Head Full of Ghosts. I haven't read Head Full of Ghosts yet, but I know. It's on my shelf back there. It's right next to Richard Matheson's Duel, which Paul Tremblay approved of when I tagged him on Instagram about it. He's like, I'm fine with being next to Richard Matheson. But, yeah, all I've heard about Head Full of Ghosts is that it's The Exorcist for, like, modern audiences, which sounds great to me. I'm all in. The second I heard that, I was like, this is the fastest Amazon purchase I've ever made in my life. But it, just make that. Just do that. Let's see Paul Tremblay's name get brought up. We don't, you know, I love William Peter Blatty. I'm always going to love William Peter Blatty, but if Paul Tremblay gave us the blueprint for a modern take or whatever you want to say on The Exorcist, just do that. And I know it's being made into a movie, but last I heard, isn't it just going to Netflix now?
We actually didn't get to talk to him a whole lot about that during the interview, but when I met him last year and talked to him about it a little bit, there were rumblings of it being directed by Osgood Perkins, which is why we were talking about Hansel and Gretel and The Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, and it was moving forward with him, so it's still potentially going to Netflix because that's where Pretty Thing That Lives in the House came out on. So yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw it there soon. I think Osgood Perkins is a great pick to direct that. He's got the right tone for it.
I agree. I just wish it would get a wider release. Well, I don't have Netflix. My girlfriend has Netflix, for example. So for me, I'm going to miss this now.
Yeah, I'm excited for that adaptation to finally happen, for Grady Hendrix's Horror Store to finally get an actual adaptation coming out, because that's just one of the most fun examples of a haunted book to come out. I can't call it a haunted house, a haunted store to come out. Yeah. Those two guys know what they're doing in their respective fields.
Yeah, it's almost like they're really good writers, you know?
Well, hey, you joined the pantheon of really good writers who have been able to grace the boards of this show, so.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome That's to awesome. the Slashenings Library. So far, I've got you three. I've got Michelle, who owns the Green Hand Bookstore. I've got a whole literary vibe going back here.
That's awesome. I love your show.
Thank you.
You can edit that out if you want, but I do. I listen. It's one of the ones that I make a point to listen to every time it comes on. There's other ones I'm just like, nah, I'm good. But Slashenings comes on, and I'm not going to plug other podcasts, but there are other ones, and I'm like, yes, please. I always listen to those. But yours is definitely one of the five that I say that I listen to frequently and religiously.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that.
I don't know. I always put podcasts on, you know, when I'm driving. It's always, and I find yours is perfect. I also listen to it when I'm playing video games too. And I'm always like, oh, all right, that's cool. So it's just nice to, I don't know. I have an Amazon device that if I say her name, she'll wake up. I'm always like, play this. And she's like, yeah, I got you. And I don't know. It's just perfect.
Awesome. Well, thanks, man. There are a lot of really good horror podcasts out right now. Like my buddies over in the Black and White Fright one have been doing this forever. They're kind of who inspired this show. There were a lot of really good ones on the Fangoria Network. And as soon as they understandably disbanded that for a bit, I feel like I got stuck in a void of not having new ones to listen to. So I'm always on the map for a new podcast as well. So
I can make some recommendations there if you like.
Yeah. Send them out. Let's give them unpaid for plugs on my show.
Yes.
What do you got?
Night of the Living Podcast.
Yep.
Is you listen to them?
I've heard of the time with you. Yeah, those are good. That's a good crew.
Oh, they're awesome. Night of the Living Podcast. I love if you're into real, not real, you know what I mean. Nonfiction stuff. Somewhere in the Skies is a cool one by Ryan Sprague. It's he talks a lot about like aliens and abductions and stuff. He's a nice guy. Trying to think, what are the other ones that I listened to? Oh, Weird Transmissions by Curtis Lawson. He's an author. He hosts a really cool podcast, and it's Weird, WYRD. So I would say those three are pretty solid. Oh, New Horror Express. Do you know New Horror Express?
I do not know New Horror Express. Who's on that one?
It's hosted by a guy named Scott Murphy out of Scotland, and he's awesome. It's a really good show, really great. I just listened to an episode with the director of a movie called A Ghost Waits, which sounds really cool. I can't wait to watch it. It's not, I haven't seen it on Amazon or anything, so I'm waiting for it to come out. But he just does really cool interviews with indie authors and indie filmmakers and stuff like that.
Awesome. We've got plenty of material to research. If anyone's listening to this and has seen everything that has been talked about that I have egregiously not seen, go online and yell at me for it. There's a whole bunch out there. And give me more recommendations. I'm always desperate to find more stuff. So if you guys are listening and think that there's stuff that I haven't seen yet, yell at me about it. We'll talk about it.
But, I swear I won't recommend anything else.
Well, we have been going for a little bit here, so we will start to wrap it up. Today is the new release day for Her Infernal Name and Other Nightmares, so please do yourself a favor and pick it up. I got the sneak peek on it, and there's so much good gross, good fun. It's just a good horror collection to pick up. You need it on your shelves, trust me.
Thank you. I love that. You need it on your shelves. I love
you do.
That.
It's a good horror anthology, never goes out of style, because even if you've got 5 minutes to read a short one, you've got a couple hours to read through, there's always time for good horror anthology. I've got 2 or 3 shelves full of them upstairs. There's just a lot of good material in all of them, and yours is a treasure trove of it. So it's definitely worth having up there with the other pantheons of good horror literature.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
And now, where can people follow you online?
I'm mostly on Instagram at Robert Ottone, RobertOttone. You can find me at spookyhousepress.com also. And I'm on the Facebooks as well. Rob Ottone. I don't really use Facebook that much, but mostly on Instagram at Robert Ottone.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show, man. I appreciate it. And everyone listening to this should go buy the copy right now. Either buy it digitally on your Kindles or venture out into the disease-ridden world and buy it from an actual shelf.
Good luck.
Thank you all so much for listening. And thank you, Rob, for the personally signed copy. I'm looking forward to that beer once all this is over. The book is out now, and if you check out the Slashing social media posts, the cover will be posted everywhere, as well as a few glamour shots of it amongst my personal library. My Halloween playlist is up on Spotify now. If you search for Slashing's Halloween, you'll find a collection of tunes that really sets the mood for pumpkin carving. If you're enjoying the show, you can give it a follow at @SlashingsPod. It's on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. With spooky season in full effect, now's a great time to share this show with your horror and Halloween-loving fiends. You can also email me directly at SlashingsPod@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. That's all I got for you this week. I'll be back in 2 more with a cast member of one of my favorite New England haunted houses. Until then, wear a mask, register to vote, and keep it creepy.